John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for July 28th through August 3rd, 2012. U.S. presidential candidate Romney's comment in Jerusalem worries the Palestinians, while Israeli human rights groups report shows more government money for settlers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the nonviolent activities in the West Bank. One journalist was among those injured this week as Israeli troops used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets to suppress anti-wall protests organized in a number of West Bank communities. IMEMC's Kelly Joyner with the details.
On Friday, anti-wall protests were organized at the village of Kufr Kadum in the northern West Bank, in addition to Bilayin, Nayalin, and Nabi Saleh in the central West Bank. The southern West Bank village of Al-Masara also organized a protest against the wall this week. In Kufr Kadum, Israeli troops fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at the villagers and their international supporters before they left the village. One journalist was lightly wounded as he was hit with a tear gas bomb in his leg. Many others were treated for tear gas inhalation. Troops also fired tear gas at nearby olive trees, setting them on fire. The fire was put out by local youth after destroying a number of trees. In the central West Bank, troops also used tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets against Bilayin, Nayalin, and Nabi Saleh, and their international and Israeli supporters. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation at all three locations. At Bilayin and Nayalin, protesters managed to reach the Israeli illegal wall, but in Nabi Saleh, Israeli soldiers stopped the march at the village entrance. Elsewhere on Friday, in the southern West Bank, Al-Masara villagers protest weekly anti-wall. Israeli forces stationed there forced people back into the village using rifle butts and batons. No injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Kelly Joyner.
U.S. presidential candidate Romney's comment in Jerusalem worries the Palestinians. Meanwhile, Arafat's widow demands an official investigation into her husband's death IMEMC's George Shmawi has more.
The visit of Mitt Romney, the Republican candidate for the American presidential elections, to Jerusalem was very worrying for many, especially the Palestinians, mainly because of his remarks regarding the deteriorated Palestinian economy and the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. On Israeli settlements issue, the Obama administration had refused to accord Israel blanket approval. Rather, it affirms that the final status of the settlements can only be resolved as part of a mutually agreed peace deal negotiated between Israelis and Palestinians. Yet Romney declared that the settlements issue was a topic to be discussed only between the United States and Israel themselves behind closed doors. He also added insult to the injury when he related the deteriorated Palestinian economy to cultural difference in comparison to Israel's economy, totally ignoring the Israeli military occupation of the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians have become worried about what kind of people Romney is depending on for reporting, if this would be his vision about the most complicated Middle East crisis. Meanwhile, the debt crisis gripping the Palestinian Authority has forced the Palestinian leaders to turn to Israel for funding as it struggles to stay solvent. The Palestinian economy could not survive with the largest of foreign donors. The dependence on foreign aid has been heightened in the past decade as Israeli restrictions on movement and activity in the West Bank and Gaza forced millions of Palestinians into a crushing economic recession. Despite being the source of Palestine's economic decline, Tel Aviv has also become the most dependable source of funding for the Palestinian Authority. Prime Minister Salam Fayyad and Israeli Finance Minister Yuval Steinitz agreed to terms of a new financial agreement to go into effect in January 2013. The new agreement will create a larger monitoring infrastructure to track the flow of goods into and out of Palestine. It will also construct pipelines to deliver Israeli petroleum products to Palestinian markets. This is not the first time the Israeli government has offered to cover the PA's administrative costs, but the new trend is important for the peace process and further negotiations about Palestinian statehood. By agreeing to cover some of the financial burdens of the Palestinian Authority, Tel Aviv is ensuring Palestine's dependence on Israel for its survival. This was the conclusion of the World Bank just last week when it released a comprehensive report on the Palestinian economy. The World Bank concluded that the deepening occupation of Palestine was both hindering economic growth and undermining the future of a stand-all state in the West Bank and Gaza. In other news, Soha Arafat, widow of the late Palestinian president Yasser Arafat, formally requested a French investigation into the death of her husband in a French military hospital in 2004. Mrs. Arafat brought a formal complaint to French authorities on behalf of herself and her daughter Zahwa. The complaint charges assassination following new questions raised by an investigation done by Al Jazeera News. The investigation, in which a prominent Swiss lab detected traces of deadly radiation of polonium-210 on the late president's personal effects, ultimately proved inconclusive and recommended Arafat's remains be tested. The Palestinian Authority has agreed to do so with the permission of the family. According to a statement by the family's French lawyer Pierre-Olivier Sour, the request was an attempt to, quote, establish the truth in honor of their husband and father, unquote. A French judge will decide whether to accept the complaint and open an investigation. So far, French authorities have refused to comment about the circumstances of Arafat's death, citing confidentiality laws. For IMC News, this is George Rishmael.
This week, Israeli forces killed a Palestinian worker and wounded three others at Azayim checkpoint east of occupied Jerusalem. While during invasions targeting West Bank communities, Israeli soldiers arrested 10 Palestinians, including a child. IMEMC's Greg Harrington reports.
On Monday of this week, one Palestinian worker was killed at dawn and two others were wounded when Israeli soldiers stationed at a roadblock east of occupied East Jerusalem opened fire at their car under the pretext that they did not heed soldiers ordering them to stop. Palestinian sources confirmed that the men were on their way to look for work in East Jerusalem. Staying in the West Bank, the human rights group Peace Now, which criticizes the settlements, issued a report this week saying that Israel is spending more on settlers in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem than on the average Israeli resident. According to Peace Now, the Israeli government has allocated 1.6 billion shekels, or nearly $400 million, from its budget this year to be spent on West Bank settlements. The human rights group indicated that this is a 13% increase from last year's spending on settlers. Yariv Oppenheimer, General Director of Peace Now.
According to the information that we got, we can see that every year the government invests 1 billion shekel more in the settlements than in the other place inside Israel. We know that the settlers have a very strong political lobby, and they try to push the current government to give them more benefits. And this is one of our motivations to convince the Israeli public that this is against the Israeli interest, and if Israel would like to have a better economy and to support peace, so the best thing will be to cut the budgets coming from the settlements.
The Peace Now report noted that most of the government money that goes into settlements is spent on infrastructure, security, and education. However, the increase in money that the Israeli government is spending on these settlements is matched only by a 4% increase on the population of those settlements. There are 199 settlements in the West Bank on land that was occupied by the State of Israel in 1967. When those settlements expand and develop, the Palestinian landowners suffer due to the consequences. Palestinian researcher Suhail Khalilia, head of the Settlements Watch Unit at the Applied Research Institute of Jerusalem, explains.
The effect that they have on the Palestinian society is immense. The land that falls under the jurisdiction of these settlements comes to about 40% of the West Bank area. Now, when we talk about 40%, we're talking about Palestinian losing agricultural land, losing natural resources, and most importantly, water resources, which is the main element here in the West Bank.
In other news, the Energy and Natural Resources Authority in the Gaza Strip said on Thursday that it had managed to run the Gaza power plant in full capacity for the first time in 6 years. According to the Energy Authority, the plant, which is the only power plant in Gaza, can provide residents with electricity 24 hours a day, as long as there is enough fuel available. The power plant was running with only 25% of its capacity due to the lack of fuel and the damage caused by Israel when it bombarded the power plant in 2006. It took nearly 6 years to rehabilitate the power plant due to the closure. The rehabilitation of the plant was made possible by funds from the Islamic Bank and fuel provided by Qatar through Egypt. For IMEMC News, this is Craig Harrington.
And that's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Afghanistan, 2nd of August. NATO is reporting the death of two soldiers of unreported nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 1st of August. NATO is reporting the deaths of two soldiers of unreported nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 1st of August. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 1st of August. NATO is reporting the death of another soldier of unreported nationality from an IED blast in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan, 3rd of August. Another NATO helicopter went down. Nobody was killed. No word on wounded crew members, and no word on whether or not the helicopter was shot down. Afghanistan, 4th of August. Presumed Taliban fighters intercepted and destroyed a shipment of 3 containers from Karachi, Pakistan to NATO forces in Afghanistan. Insurgents intercepted the trucks, ordered the drivers and the cleaners out, and burned the shipment. We'll be right back.
Afghanistan, 3rd of August. A Task Force North convoy was ambushed with automatic weapons and a pair of IEDs. The convoy was supported by Italy's Caserta 8th Regiment. 3 Italian soldiers were wounded. The convoy was racing to assist an American convoy stranded by a vehicle accident when it was hit at about 11:30 p.m. Mr. Barack Obama, this just never seems to stop. Now's the time to throw in the towel, bring all the troops home today, not in 2014, 2 years after the election.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
The Consumer Financial Protection Board, or CFPB, created by the Dodd-Frank Banking Reform Law, launched its first major enforcement action in mid-July against credit card giant Capital One. The company agreed to pay $150 million back to customers for marketing services they did not need. Capital One also paid a $60 million fine. The $210 million award is just the first step for the CFPB in reining in abuses by credit card companies and non-bank financial institutions. Moreover, several big banks, including J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, and HSBC, were sued by Hawaii's Attorney General for selling so-called add-on products to credit card customers. CFPB Director Richard Cordray won billions of dollars in settlements from Merrill Lynch and AIG when he previously served as Ohio's Attorney General. In its early days, the CFPB attracted key officials from the financial services industry who understood the metrics credit card companies used to market products to customers. Now the Bureau is using the same metrics to test-run new single-page disclosure forms as part of its Know Before You Owe campaign. Overall, the banking and credit card industry remains hostile to the CFPB, the brainchild of consumer advocate Elizabeth Warren, who is now running for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts.
You may remember that executive with AIG who whined to Congress in 2009 about getting emails saying he should be hanged from piano wire after getting millions of dollars in bonuses from his bailed-out financial firm. Now there is a banking scandal in Iran linked to the very top of the regime. The Washington Post is reporting that a court in Iran has sentenced four bankers to death for a $2.6 billion embezzlement scheme. Additional bankers are going to jail, and some of them are going to be whipped. A total of 39 banking officials have been tried and convicted. This has happened while people in Iran have seen skyrocketing prices and lurid stories about the banking scandal carried out by people close to the regime. Now, I can't verify from the Post report the people being hanged, whipped, and jailed for up to 25 years are the Iranian president's bank embezzling buddies, but it sure sounds like it is. Whatever the problems with the government of Iran, and there are a lot of those, a broken clock is right twice a day. How many people in the U.S. who are choking under mortgage payments, or worse, have lost their homes to foreclosure, would really like to see the fat cats at Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Countrywide Financial, and J.P. Morgan Chase have to face the rope and the whipping post. Hey, Mr. AIG executive, at least they're not using piano wire.
This election year, one of the central debates between Democrats and Republicans, between President Obama and presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney, is over how much should the nation's wealthiest citizens have to pay in federal taxes. On that issue, polls find most voters in favor of letting the Bush-era tax cuts lapse for the wealthy while retaining tax cuts for families earning $250,000 and under annually. But a new report undertaken by the Tax Justice Network paints a disturbing picture of tax avoidance, finding that the super-rich in the U.S. and around the world are hiding at least $21 trillion in offshore accounts, avoiding paying millions of dollars in taxes in their home countries. In the report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited, the Tax Justice Network found that the wealth hidden in tax shelters is equivalent to the United States and Japanese economies combined. While the public is familiar with tax havens and banks located on far-off exotic islands, the report found that UBS, Credit Suisse, and Goldman Sachs are among the top private banks managing offshore accounts for the world's wealthiest people. The authors of the report, relying on data from the World Bank, the IMF, the United Nations, central banks, the Bank for International Settlements, and other sources, concluded that the impact of unpaid taxes is staggering, where global financial inequality is much greater than originally estimated and growing. Your reporter spoke with the lead author of the report, James S. Henry, a former chief economist with McKinsey & Company, who summarizes his investigation, tax cheating's effect on inequality, and how governments can reform banking regulations to recapture billions in lost tax revenue.
Well, the headline number is $21 trillion of offshore private financial wealth. That's bonds and stocks, as well as bank deposits on alternate investments like hedge funds. It doesn't include so-called non-financial assets like real estate, art collections, yachts, and intellectual property. There's an important offshore market there as well. You know, most of the City of London is actually owned offshore at this point through offshore companies. What we're focusing on here is just financial wealth. Much of this is concentrated in the hands of about 10 million people at most, around the planet, and the growth of the activity has been accounted for by a relative handful of major international banks, which have made it a business to help wealthiest people on the planet take their money out of their home countries, invest it abroad tax-free, and using a variety of schemes to defend it against taxation. The havens that we all hear about, the so-called treasure islands like the Caymans and Bermuda and the Bahamas and Panama and Jersey. These are really to be thought of mainly as conduits in this system. The real destination havens for this capital and the place it actually ends up being invested are the major financial centers of the world, New York, London, Zurich and Geneva, Belgium is another one, Liechtenstein. These are places that people actually end up investing their capital. Nobody wants to have their funds sitting in, you know, Tortola or Bahamas for very long. So they use shell companies that are registered in places like Cayman Islands or Bahamas, and then the ultimate investments are made in these major countries.
James, briefly, please tell our listeners a little bit about how these offshore tax havens contribute to income inequality in the United States particularly.
Well, I think if it's possible for the wealthy to basically go back to the 1920s and roll back the clock to the days before really progressive income taxation, effectively legislating themselves a tax cut by taking funds offshore, you know, it's hard to reduce your tax rate below zero. You know, those practices are things that ordinary folks have a hard time keeping up with. So small business has a hard time, for example, taking advantage of the offshoring of intellectual property that companies like Google and Microsoft and Pfizer and other leading technology companies have used. They basically park their intellectual property in Bermuda or Ireland and then pay themselves royalties that are not taxed. And then they come back to the U.S. government and ask for a tax break when they repatriate all these profits they've offshored back to the United States. That's in the corporate world, and that's separate from the price of offshore revisited. We're talking there about corporate, and this is about individuals. But there's a lot of ways in which this haven architecture has been abused and affects the distribution of wealth. One of them is on the corporate side. On the individual side, you know, it's basically an invitation to the more aggressive members of the wealthiest class to hide money offshore and to not report it in the home country and basically avoid any tax burden at all. So effectively, there's a lot of Romneys out there, and he's just one of many folks, probably not even the most aggressive in terms of this practice.
What's been the reaction to this report, and are there any viable solutions here in terms of reining in these tax shelters through international treaties or such? I wish it was simple, but I'm sure it's not. You'll probably tell me that.
We've seen a tremendous response you know, from all over the globe. I mean, I've had inquiries from India and Russia, and journalists in Argentina. I mean, Chile, this is a global story. It's kind of unprecedented, the response we've had. And I've been studying this field since the 1980s. I mean, I wrote my first piece on this in 1986. And I have been waiting for, you know, any kind of interest on the part of policymakers. I think, you know, what to do about it, there are many things we can do to clamp down on the worst abuses, and we can have automatic information reporting, which the United States has with its friends in Canada and the UK, but it doesn't extend now to Mexico. The Mexican finance minister asked Tim Geithner to help share the same information on Mexican investors that he was giving to the Canadians, and they got no response. You know, that automatic information reporting on offshore earnings is an important step forward. I think regulating pirate banking and the kind of misbehavior of the big banks here is really something we ought to consider. And then it may be possible to get people to agree on a minimal tax while we're waiting for tougher enforcement. You know, that would just a 0.5% of what's parked in the banks now would generate enough to pay the entire foreign aid bill from the OECD. So at least we would get something from all the offshore tax evasion, the drug money, all the dirty money that's sitting in these offshore accounts while we're waiting for, you know, tighter enforcement.
That was James S. Henry, a former chief economist with McKinsey & Company and lead author of the Tax Justice Network report titled The Price of Offshore Revisited. Find links to the report and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
On the 28th of July, thousands of people, many from communities damaged by natural gas fracking, rallied at the U.S. Capitol, then marched on the American Natural Gas Association, and finally the American Petroleum Institute, or API.
The water's on fire!
The indulgence on the fun lights is cast a shadow on the world. Our devotion to our appetites betraying us all.
Poison water!
One of the speakers at the rally at the Capitol before the march joked that the natural gas fracking industry must have gotten their exemptions from environmental laws by drilling a well from a rig inside the Washington Monument to the House and Senate office buildings with which to inject cash instead of hydrofracking chemicals to get that exemption. He began by pointing to the Washington Monument.
It looks a little bit like a drill rig. And I think in the middle of the night, when no one was paying attention, Aubrey McClendon and Tibor Pickens, they somehow got a drill rig up inside of that Washington Monument. And they drilled a well. And they have a horizontal well bore sticking all the way up underneath that building over there. And they're injecting not carcinogenic chemicals, not neurotoxins, not volatile organic compounds, but money.
Yeah.
And cash. A lot of money. Now, if you want to outbid them,
if anybody here has got a spare $747 million, which is the amount of money that they spent getting the exemption to one law, just one, $750 million for the exemption to the Safe Drinking Water Act.
There was also a speaker from the Blackfeet Nation on how hydrofracking wells are damaging their land, which shockingly mirrors how tar sands oil extraction is doing damage to the Lakota.
I am a proud member of the Blackfoot Confederacy. We are the indigenous land caretakers of the headwaters of the North American continent. We live where sacred sites to us practice our way of life are at stake from the fracking. I come here today and I represent over 60,000 members of the Blackfoot Confederacy in Montana, Alberta, and Saskatchewan. The oil and gas companies right now are targeting the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana, the Blood Reserve in Canada, the North Pagan in Canada, and the Blackfoot proper in Mission, Alberta. We have oil companies bringing in with them drug dealers, prostitution, a threat to our very cultural way of life.
Uncommitted flight, more destruction will unfold, Mother Earth will show.
The first stop of the march was the American Natural Gas Association, which lobbies for gas frackers. Several folks had brought contaminated well water, which had been filled with chemicals by nearby fracking projects. Here it comes.
Somebody's drinking water.
That's drinking water contaminated by fracking from a well in Butler, Pennsylvania. This is supposed to be drinking water from a well, but look at it. This is drinking water? We're supposed to drink this stuff? Yet we're handling it here in toxic protection suits as toxic waste. If I were to take one of these bottles of this so-called drinking water and go inside that office and dump it under carpet, I could be arrested for dumping a hazardous substance. And yet here it is as well water that somebody's supposed to drink. The march culminated when all the marchers, thousands strong, swarmed in on the American Petroleum Institute, the notorious lobbyist for the oil and gas industry that was once known mostly for raiding motor oil, now is known mostly for bribing congressmen. A mock gas drilling rig was erected in front of API and then torn down while another group of people sat down blocking the doors. The police didn't even attempt to interfere with this siege. It lasted about half an hour.
Set up in front of the American Petroleum Institute, or in this case, a gas fracking rig.
During the siege, many of the marchers chanted, "The water, the water, the water is on fire. We don't need no fracking. Let the corporations burn." One of the most amazing things that has resulted from natural gas fracking has been that in many places, enough gas has leaked into well water or occasionally municipal water that it comes out people's taps, giving water that can literally be ignited with a cigarette lighter, with a gas burning in a flame over the tap while the water heads down towards the drain. And here's what people had to say about that outside the offices of the American Petroleum Institute.
The water! The water! The water's on fire! We don't need no fracking, let the corporation burn! The water! The water! The water's on fire! We don't need no fracking, let the corporation burn!
The climax of the entire protest may have been the moment when the mock gas fracking rig set up in front of the American Petroleum Institute was torn down.
Stop the frack attack!
You're about to take it down!
Attack is
hurricane hit it. In this case, a hurricane of protest. Blockade is taken down without arrest.
Argentina, the largest producer of natural gas in South America, sits on huge untapped reserves of shale gas, which can be extracted by hydraulic fracturing or fracking, the controversial process linked to water contamination in the United States. In April, Argentina's President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner nationalized the majority of shares of YPF, the former state-run oil company, which was sold to Spanish oil firm Repsol in the late 1990s. Fernandez complained that the Spanish oil company was milking its profits from existing oil and gas operations and not investing in new energy production. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, Argentina has the third highest potential for shale gas in the world behind the United States and China. The Argentine government has launched several studies of the potential of shale gas development. Fracking through shale rock in the United States uses industrial chemicals and highly pressurized water. Across the United States, charges have been leveled that the drilling technique has resulted in the contamination of groundwater. In Argentina, energy giants like ExxonMobil, Apache, and French-based Total are pushing to invest in shale gas projects. Argentine energy consultant Mariana Matranga told the Interpress service that fracking technology has only been in use for a short time in the world. It uses a significant amount of water, and the whole watershed needs to be monitored very carefully. It can be done well or done badly. A lot depends on how much is invested.
Fracking is a form of natural gas drilling, an alternative to oil, cause the oil kept spilling, bringing jobs to small towns, so everybody's willing. People turn on the lights and the drillers make a killing.
Water goes into the pipe into the ground. The pressure cranes fishes 7,000 feet down. The cracks release the gas that powers your town. That will frack, yeah, totally frack.
But there's more in the water than just H2O. Toxic chemicals help to make the fluid flow. With names like benzene and formaldehyde, you better keep them far away from the water supply.
The drillers say the fishes are a mile below the groundwater pumped into American homes, but don't tell it to the residents of Cerro Guayo, that water's frack. We're talking benzene.
What the frack is going on with all this fracking going on? I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think my water's on fire tonight.
So it all goes back to 2005. Bush said gas drillers didn't have to comply with the Safe Drinking Water Act before too long. It was frack, baby, frack until the break of dawn.
With the EPA out, it was up to the states, but they didn't have the money to investigate. Sick people couldn't prove fracking was to blame. All the while, water wells were going up in flames.
Cause it's hard to contain all the methane released. It can get into the air, it can get into the streams. It's a greenhouse gas worse than CO2. Fracking done wrong could lead to climate change too.
Now it's not that drillers should never be fracking, but the current regulation is severely lacking. Reduce the toxins contained in the gas and waste water, and the people will get sick and the planet will get hotter. Hot.
What the frack is going on with all this fracking going on? I think we need some facts to come to light. I know we want our energy, but nothing ever comes for free. I think our water's on fire tonight. As
of the 4th of August, it's been a week since mountain mobilization walked into the Hobet Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine in Lincoln County, West Virginia, and shut it down with civil disobedience. This is the largest mountaintop removal coal mine in all of Appalachia, so large that the mine bosses thought they would not be the one protesters hit. When 50 people showed up, and some of them locked themselves onto a rock truck, other heavy equipment, and up a tree, it was a complete and total surprise for that particular mine.
Both West Virginia State Police and the mine bosses responded with absolute fury. 20 people are still in jail as of the 4th of August, a whole week after the action, still being held on $25,000 bail each. Dustin Steele, who was beaten by police, was not released until Wednesday, the 1st of August, 4 days after he was beaten by police. On the 2nd of August, 5 days after the mine shut down, another 19 activists were released after plea deals of $500 fines and a year of probation for trespassing. Huh! Trespassing. The mine owners are notorious for telling West Virginia residents to either sell their home to the mine at a discount and agree never to live in the same county again, or they will make sure the house is made worthless by the mine. Another 30 activists managed to get off the mine site without being arrested, but West Virginia state troopers ordered their pickup vehicles to stay away under threat of arrest and impoundment. This forced the rest of the activists to walk for miles under a stream of harassment from some of the miners. I'll let someone who was there give you the details from a video posted to YouTube by Ramps, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival.
Ultimately, it was a group of about 30 people. You know, we left, went stage, waited for everyone to come, then we walked. There was a number of interactions between sheriffs, deputies, mainly West Virginia State Patrol, who indicated we should just keep on going.
Good job, dude.
As I told the officer several times, if we can get out of here sooner, everyone will be happier and healthier and safer in this whole situation. When I asked why that van couldn't just come through and pick us up, and he said the street was closed to residents only.
We've had to shut down the road for residents only.
Yet the so-called Friends of Cole were permitted to drive on these same roads and harass the protesters from their vehicles. That's an interesting thing to say. The West Virginia State Police were founded to assist coal mine owners resist unions and put down strikes by miners during the West Virginia coal wars.
Also, I was told by one person that lived in that area that was friendly that a lot of folks that were coming up and down and harassing us did not live in that area.
So much for residents only, eh?
It seemed that it was closed to anyone that wanted to be helpful in the situation of getting us off the side of the road and out of danger from people harassing us.
Here's how the folks driving the pickup vehicles were treated very differently than out-of-area harassers sent by the so-called Friends of Cole.
We got to the police blockade, and they let us through. They told us not to come back, and if we showed our faces or our cars there again, we would be arrested. But we observed other cars that were not official cars in any capacity with Friends of Coal stickers being allowed to drive in and out of that blockade, with the police knowing that they were antagonistic.
As a result, 30 protesters had to run a gauntlet of harassment on foot for hours.
Looks like we are going to keep moving all the way through the highway until the police allow our caravan of vehicles to come pick us up. And these counter-protesters are going to be following us the whole way.
That could have gotten someone killed if just one of the harassers had popped off. Instead of protecting lives, police went so far as to arrest one person for possessing a debit card after saying he did not have ID.
Jonathan stepped out of the car. He said, "I do not have identification with him." The officer searched him and took his wallet and pulled out his debit card and said, "This is identification. You lied to me. You're under arrest."
I was never read my Miranda rights, and this is an exact quote, but something to the extent of, "You're in the middle of the fucking mountains. I'd stop fucking around if I were you." Slams the door. They're, you know, saying things like, "You know, you're lucky you're in this police car right now. If we let you out, those miners would just beat your ass." Like, "Oh, these miners don't give a fuck. They'll kill you and throw you down into an abandoned mine. There's a lot of places where they won't even find the bodies." Stuff like that. When they asked any kind of question that got to the substance of as to why I was in that forest. I pretty much didn't say very much at all, and they were kind of harassing me, and not in a threatening way, but just saying, you know, I don't get this whole remaining silent thing.
They did let him out of the police car in the end, in an intentionally dangerous place.
So I get let off basically on this little highway in the middle of nowhere with the direction that I can walk a quarter of a mile to the right to a gas station, which turns out there wasn't a payphone there. My cell phone was confiscated by Sergeant O'Brien when I was arrested. I was getting folks who were stopping and harassing me, people who were yelling outside, and this was avoidable.
What a reaction to a peaceful civil disobedience.
Folks who came here to demonstrate against mountaintop removal and all its atrocities in a way that did not threaten or cause any harm to human life were put in unsafe situations, and police allowed that to continue just like they've allowed that to continue in the past. And that's what it looks like when the West Virginia State Police operates on behalf of the coal industry.
They knew we were in danger. They had no way, shape, or form offered to help out in any way.
I felt very strongly that with the knowledge that the local police officers knew about the environment, that they most definitely placed us in danger.
The West Virginia State Police were formed in response to the coal wars and were essentially a private arm of industry used in repressing union miners who were fighting for, you know, basic decent living conditions, fighting to not be paid in company script, fighting for some level of control over their lives. And that's the origin of the West Virginia State Police. So let's not be surprised when that same institution to this day is being brutal against Appalachians who are standing up to reclaim their homeland, their history, their heritage, and their ecology.